Welcome to Reading, Writing, Rolling, Imagination and Fiction in the Age of Harry Potter. This is episode 9, where we will be talking with Dr. Cecilia Conchar-Farr about Harry Potter and the Prisoner of the Academy, reading Harry Potter as serious literature. Thanks for joining us for Reading, Writing, Rolling. I am your host, Katie McDaniel, professor of history at Marietta College and co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds 2. Our resident expert is, as always, John Granger, the Dean of Harry Potter Scholars and author of many, many books about the Harry Potter series, including the Deathly Hallows Lectures. So, John, you've been working a lot on some kind of new information or new puzzles in Rowling studies. So what have you been thinking about lately?
Wow.
Got some Hogwarts professor posts, you got some things about wands, you got J.K. Rowling's favorite poem.
Yeah. Where do you start? We got Adela Meany's interview is available again for the first time in 10 years. That's a miracle. As the Dean of Harry Potter Scholars, I've been asked at least once a quarter for 10 years if I had a copy of that interview.
Oh, wow.
And no, I don't have a copy of that interview. I didn't until a couple of days ago. That's available now. All the things that Rowling had said about her psychological condition, her suicidal thing, the CBT therapy, all of her comments about fundamentalists, all her comments about gay Dumbledore. It was a landmark interview that really provides a lot of context for the controversies going on now in terms of Fantastic Beasts. The poem they found of the A Terrible Doubt of Appearances, that Whitman's beautiful poem from Leaves of Grass, that Rowling 2009 contributed to a charity anthology. There's a lot going on. Beatrice Groves wrote some beautiful posts on literary illusion in The Silkworm. Wow, it's a great time to be a Potter scholar. And there's this giant issue that I'm going to take about a month to unpack before I really reveal it, that we'll have to wait until we have that conversation here.
Oh, wow.
Stay tuned. Yeah.
Tantalizing.
It's gross to be that way, but I'm afraid to let this one out of the bag because I really want to check up all the possible angles with it this morning. It will confirm the alchemy hypothesis and will play into what we're talking about today in large part, I think, which will be anchor biases. But that's for another show.
All right. Yes. Okay. That's a good tease there, John. And I know you've been posting a lot at hogwartsprofessor.com, so our listeners can check that out if they like. John, I was going to tell you about a recent publication that I had. I think I've told you some about my work on sort of using the Dumbledore's youth stories of the Deathly Hallows to sort of think about fake news and what fake news is. And I published Dumbledore's Uncertain Past, A Harry Potter Approach to Evaluating Sources in Dialogue, the Interdisciplinary Journal of Popular Culture and Pedagogy. And that is up, and it's a free online journal, and people can check that out if they like.
Of course they like.
Yes, I hope so. I think it's fun. Like. It's a fun exercise that I've done with class. So,
what's the website address again?
Well, it's called Dialogue, the Interdisciplinary Journal of Popular Culture and Pedagogy. And if you type that in, you'll get right to it, and it's the current issue.
I have to type all that in? There's no way I'll be able to do that.
I think you'll get Dialogue and Interdisciplinary, and I think you'll have it.
Okay, good.
So,
thank goodness.
Well, let me introduce our special guest for today. Our special guest is Dr. Cecilia Conchar-Farr, the Professor of English and Women's Studies and Chair of the Department of English and International Languages in the Women's College of St. Catherine University, a.k.a. St. Kate's.
That's us.
Which is in Minneapolis, St. Paul, Minnesota. Dr. Farr has taught a seminar called 6 Degrees of Harry Potter. She has led international trips with a Harry Potter theme. I would love to go on something like that. That sounds awesome.
How about it?
And has compiled an essay collection by undergraduate students called A Wizard of Their Age, Critical Essays from the Harry Potter Generation, published by SUNY in 2015. She is also working on a new edited volume that examines the Harry Potter novels from a variety of literary criticism perspectives. Welcome to the show, Cecilia.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
It's really great to have you on. John and I met you, Cecilia, at the Harry Potter Conference at Chestnut Hill College in outside Philadelphia, where you were the plenary speaker.
And I hope that was such a fun weekend.
Isn't that a great conference? Just so much fun. Boy. And I thought your plenary speech was just a great capper. I got a lot of good food for thought about that, that I actually brought back into a Harry Potter class I was teaching last fall. So that was a lot of fun. So
thank you.
Let's get right into it, Cecilia. So tell us, how did you first encounter the Harry Potter books?
You know, I've written about this a couple of times. It was through my children. We were on a road trip, and I needed something for them to read, and somebody had recommended the first book, and it was just before the second one came out. So we were traveling out to do some hiking and visit some family in Utah, and we took along the first one and read it on the way, and by the time we finished the first one, we were in Salt Lake City the day the second one came out, and so we grabbed that one, and the three of us became fans for the rest of their teenage years. The kids are still reading them, and they're 28 and 25 now. My son just recently reread all of them.
Wow.
And I read them every time I teach a class, and that's been, I think, six times now. So
yeah, so when you were first reading them, did you read them, you know, as a parent reading a kid's book, or were you able to see scholarly potential in it even then? What was your initial response?
You know, I thought the first one was charming, and the second one was fun, but I didn't get really behind these as a literary project until the third one. Mm-hmm. I loved the Dementors, and so much of what she was doing was interesting. Less black and white, more gray, and then the further you read, the more complex they got, the more challenging. I was so impressed with the way that she grows with her readers in the texts, with so my daughter was the same age as Harry pretty much the whole way through, and the things that she paid attention to were things that kids the age of her protagonist would pay attention to. Mm-hmm. And I just thought that was incredibly skillful and something that we don't have critical language to really value. Most series stay at the same reading level, and what she did there, I would argue, is probably related to her being a mom and living with people that age. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of times I like to make that argument, because a lot of times we say, well, it's been the historical tradition, here's me as a feminist scholar, that the creativity of women is about childbearing, and the creativity around art was for men. And so to claim that that being a mother doesn't interfere with art making but actually enhances it, I think is a really important argument. Ursula Le Guin has made that argument, and I think that really seemed very true to me as I was reading the Harry Potter books. It really came into focus for me is when I held this little meeting in the English department to rethink our curriculum, and we invited a bunch of students, and it was a contest. Whoever brought the most students got a box of chocolates. So I was super motivated and got a lot of students there. And we said, what would you like a course about? And it wasn't, you know, a couple people said this, a couple people said that. It was like all of them said Harry Potter. It was in 2009, I think, and were knee-deep in Harry Potter, and that's what they wanted to talk about. And then when I taught the class, I realized this is something more than a children's book series. This is it's a phenomenon, a huge influence on this generation, and anybody who cares about books needs to be paying attention.
Yes, well, obviously, we totally agree on that point, and I wanted to...
No, we don't! I mean, just to be the niggling naysayer, you know. You make just so I've read your book closely. You make that point about the her raising children the same age as Harry on page 180. It's note 2 to chapter 9.
look at you.
Look at that. Gosh, did I read that book closely? I love your book. What was the name of that book again? That name of that book was...
The Ulysses Delusion.
Ulysses Delusion, Rethinking Standards of Literary Merit, and you need to read that book, whoever you are out there
listening.
It's a
great read also.
But Rowling's daughter was nowhere near Harry's age when... when Rowling was writing these books. Your point, though, is very well taken.
That she had recently been through those ages is what I'm trying to say.
Okay.
The younger ones were coming up, right? Aren't there? How many are there? Three?
Right, but they weren't born until 5, 6, and 7.
The little ones,
yeah. Rowling makes the same point in The Silkworm about... writers, male writers, she has really kind of the nasty, almost Philip Pullman-like character in The Silkworm, say disparaging things about women writers being that women can't write. And Rowling, of course, fricassees him.
Grotesquely.
Yeah.
Literally.
Yeah.
No. He survives. But I disagree with you on here is that it's not just a children's book series. I really want to attack that idea that these are children's books and say, no, they're not children's books. That they can be read by children. They can be read by bad readers, but the writing is at such a level, especially if you take the whole 7-book series as a single whole, that to think of it as a children's book series plays into an anchor bias about the value of children's literature, how serious we take it, the level of the writing, the planning, the artistry, that it's just wrong. I mean, Rowling sent the book to agents who didn't cover children's books. She said she hoped that someday it would be a cult item. That's not something that children's book writer talks about. And she doesn't read children's books, she says. It's very deceptive. She's never written a children's book since Harry Potter. She's not interested in that. She happened to write a book that involved children in a genre. She parodies a lot of genres that involve children, especially the schoolboy novel. But this is not a children's book series any more than, say, Lolita is pornography. It's a parody. Lolita is.
No, Harry Potter is.
That's right. You're not a Nabokov fan.
Oh no!
Okay,
here comes John.
Here comes. I just want to ask you. You know that Rowling says this is the author I really love.
I know that because of you.
Okay.
Thank you. I think that's fascinating. What her influences are. She loves Austin too, right?
Austin, Colette, and Nabokov are her favorite writers, and Doyle is her favorite contemporary writer.
So we do not share literary taste. You and I, nor J.K. and I.
Well, you know what? I'm a big Austin fan, and I'm a big Nabokov fan. The Colette I've read, I could take or leave. They're all three of them are parodists, and the fact that she says all of her favorite writers are parody writers would probably suggest that we should take the idea that she's writing parody a little more seriously.
At least social critique, I think. Yeah.
No, I didn't say that. Now, you're Cecilia, you're being unfair to me. It's literary parody, not social critique. But anyway, tell us why you don't like Nabokov. Lolita.
I don't like the novel Lolita. I don't watch Woody Allen movies. I think that we haven't taken seriously enough the damage that things like that do children in our world. I want to protect children. And I just would rather have my art be about something other than that.
I think what's interesting is the idea that, you know, can it be children's literature and also something that we would take seriously as having literary merit?
Yeah, Katie, that's what I was going to say, is our friend Christina Phillips Mattson, who wrote Children's Literature Grows Up, makes that argument. And in fact, I need to be more careful that when I say children's literature, I don't sound like I'm dismissing it as something lesser than. That division is harmful to the category of literature and to the category of children's literature.
Agreed. I just take the contrarian position. just say no, it's not children's literature.
Yeah.
Because it's a little bit like astrology. when you find out that someone is serious about astrology, you're a very unusual person if you don't think, oh, this is a nutter. You know, this is someone who doesn't think seriously. I can write them off as kind of a loony tune.
And I'm really lucky because here at St. Kate's, I teach with this incredible children's lit scholar. She's a librarian, Sarah Park Dolan. She calls herself a diversity ninja, and she's part of a community that is always promoting diversity in children's literature. But she's the other Hogwarts professor here at St. Kate's. She comes and lectures about Cho Chang to my Harry Potter classes and does some really good arguments about how essential the category of children's literature is and how we need to broaden it. So I've been working on not saying, oh, it's just kids' books, because I do. My students and I decided the first time I taught it that the first two would fit the category of children's literature. And then 3 and 4, they're kind of in the middle, but by 5, 6, and 7, they said these are absolutely literature without any qualifying.
Right.
Without any qualifier.
And that fits what you're saying about that she, unlike a lot of series, she like allows the series to grow with the children and, you know, maybe becomes, you know, more sophisticated as the children age. But I mean, I think, John, that you would even say those first books are actually pretty sophisticated, too, in their way.
Yeah, you really can't understand 6. A Half-Blood Prince without seeing it as a reflection of 2. I mean, the ring structure of the series makes the whole thing an integer, which is really, she's a formalist. I mean, she really is, instead of being a post-structuralist, she's a pre-structuralist. She's a formalist. And that artistry that she does, you know, she's writing about writing. That's as evident in the embedded, mise en abîme in the chocolate frog card as it is in the tale of the three brothers in Deathly Hallows. We're seeing these mirrored texts that make us reflect about the reading experience that we're having while we're having it. I mean, this is a sophistication that you won't, if you're like most people, like me, maybe I should say, if you're like me, John Chuckaluck, grew up in the 20th century. We were just, if we were reading children's literature, all the bars of resistance were lowered. We're not going to have somebody be sneaking something great by us here, because this is just a kid's book. It's a beach read. Rowling writes in this genre, and we don't even pick up that it's a parody until, 10, 15 years on.
There's also in those first couple of books the world building that has to happen in any fantasy series.
Absolutely.
And one of the things that she does so brilliantly is make that world so credible, make it so seem like you really should be waiting for your owl to tell you that you're accepted to Hogwarts this year. I mean, so many of my students, they use that phrase, I'm still waiting for my Hogwarts letter. It's so the skillful world building that a good fantasy novel requires, a lot of that happens in the first two books too. I do think the plot is a little less sophisticated in the first two. They're kind of puzzles, a little bit of a mystery story. Most of it is world building, and the moral and philosophical questions get a lot more complex as we go along. But I do like your ideas about the formalist structure of them, John. I think that's also a really relevant point about even the earliest ones.
Well, so let's talk a little bit about this, why there does seem to be this question about, children's literature, popular novels, novels by women. And Cecilia, in your book, The Ulysses Delusion, you have written some about that and where that comes from. So tell us, where do you think that attitude comes from? Why are we, like John says, why are we more ready to dismiss that as literature?
That's such I love that question, and it's a long literary history. So I'm going to go at it by telling you a little bit of my history as a critic. So I was in graduate school at the very end of the 80s when feminist literary criticism was just starting to take hold in the academy, and I knew that I wanted to be a feminist literary critic. So I did some pretty sort of high art, like that theory that we were doing in the 80s. I loved the the French feminists, and I was reading Lacan. Uh-huh. And then I started teaching. And, you know, when you teach, you really want to meet your students where they are and challenge them. And so I was really, I learned how to be really attentive to my students. And then
Lacan is hard with an undergraduate population.
Oh my gosh.
Irigaray, yeah. I mean, and all of those.
And it was so challenging to my brain and exhilarating. You know, I grew up in a working class town, and nobody in my family went to college, and you know, yeah. So it was just amazing to be that person who gets to kick around these super complicated ideas and try to make sense of them. And so I was loving that. But as a teacher, where the teacher met that critic, I started paying attention to different things. And I became pretty early a reception studies person, mm-hmm. because I was really concerned with the reader and how the reader responds to texts. So students came to me and said, we're reading Oprah, the books that Oprah tells us to read. And that was early in my teaching career. So I started paying attention to Oprah's book club and realized that that was a literary phenomenon. And so the readers pulled me into that. And then I started paying attention to those readers more broadly, who are mostly women readers, and what Oprah's books appealed to them and why. It made me pay attention to popular reading. And then I had to come up with, for me as a teacher, what are the standards of literary merit that say you should be reading The Great Gatsby? And what are the standards of literary merit that say She's Come Undone, the most popular Oprah book ever by Wally Lamb? What are the standards of literary merit that make that excellent to you? Why do you love that? And I kept asking all kinds of questions to every reader I ever encountered. So I was going to libraries and book clubs and my students all the time saying, what is it that you value about a novel? And, you know, mostly novel readers are women. So these were mostly women readers. And we came up with some really fascinating repetitions. And one of the repetitions from these groups was they wanted someone to enter the text through. And it doesn't have to be someone they identified with, but somebody that they felt like they could be invited into the text through this character. So that was one that's kind of surprised me, that was such a powerful motivation for a lot of readers. And I realized that that is not an unsophisticated thing. It's not simply identification with the characters, that it's actually a complex, empathic connection that a lot of people have been talking about in literature, empathy and its role and what we learn by throwing ourselves completely into fictional worlds. So what happened was I just came up with a bunch of other ideas about what makes something valuable, what makes a text valuable to people, and realized that most of these weren't things that I learned in my high theory days. So I tried to pull what I knew as a critic together with what I was learning from readers. And it made me realize that we had made some sort of separation somewhere along the line between what readers like and what critics are looking for. And I'm also a modernist scholar, so that moment just leaped out as when that began to happen, when we said, there's the novel that people read, and it's usually sentimental, and it involves women. And then there's the novels that are important, that are artistic and that matter. And those are usually innovative, overtly artistic, and generally don't sell well and involve male writers. And I've been tracing that separation ever since. That's kind of what the Ulysses delusion is about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you identify that there are four main areas that most people, as they're looking for a book to read, you know, just sort of, what do I want in a novel? And one is that it's relatable, which is, I think, what you were just talking about there.
That uh-huh, relatability. They make that word up, and I love it.
Another is absorbing, sort of sucks you in, that it's discussable and also informative. And then you talk about how all those four things are found in a lot of the popular reading. And I would definitely say Harry Potter for sure fits in those categories.
Yeah, when people ask me why Harry Potter is so popular, it's usually an English professor, a literature person saying, how could those novels be so popular? In fact, I was listening to a radio program this morning. We have Carrie Miller here on our NPR station, who's a very active book person. She does book programs all the time. It's a very literate community here in the Twin Cities. And she has proudly said on numerous occasions that she's never read a single Harry Potter book and allows other people to not be ashamed of that fact. There's a sort of a sense that they can't possibly be important because of the sorts of novels they are. And so I guess that what I would argue, what I have argued, is that those qualities that you were naming, Katie, are actually important qualities to develop, and that they take skill to do it, and that the reason that the Harry Potter novels are so popular is that Rowling is really good at relatability, at absorption, which means getting you so lost in the books that you don't want to put them down, that you actually do want your Hogwarts letter and you want to go live there. That's a quality that doesn't just come naturally. That's a skill that you develop. That's something that you build into the text. And discussability, that one is totally from book groups. And if you've ever read a classic in a book group and realized how dead the discussion can be because no one feels like they can say anything in the face of that greatness, you know, you lose something with readers when our judgments are not, they don't feel valued. When the decision has already been made, this has stood the test of time. There's no conversation to be had then. So,
Well, and obviously this whole podcast is because Harry Potter is very discussable. You know, we never run out of things to say.
Philosophy professors and historians and children's lit people, just not enough lit people yet, because we tend to be kind of snobbish about our territory. And I would say that book that you were talking about that I'm working on now, called Open at the Close, I think is what it's going to be called. It's about how we fail to notice as literary professionals the things that are really mattering to readers, and that's not how we should be operating, which is also, of course, one of the underlying arguments of the Ulysses delusion. But if you know anybody of the generation that we teach now and that we've been teaching for the last 10 years, you know that the way to get them to love literature and spend the rest of their life in books is to help them value what's important to them, to see why these books work, and then help them find other books that will work for them in the same way.
So let me suggest this. I don't know if you're maybe even saying that it's better that we're not considering Harry Potter as like a classic that it then becomes static and really too good for us to discuss and break apart and try to figure out for ourselves, that it would be sort of death to Harry Potter to take it in that kind of realm of, you know, kind of the way that classics are viewed.
You know, I think that John has done a really good job of approaching these texts as real literature, as classics of literature, with some traditional techniques about allusion and metaphor and structure. I think we could do that. And my argument is always that we do both, that we can't dismiss reader preferences and qualities of a text that pay attention to readers in deference to the aesthetic qualities, in deference to what we've decided is literary merit.
So because you brought up your book, I wonder if we could talk a little bit about what you're doing there, because you're trying to focus on, let's talk about Harry Potter as literature, and you invited a whole lot of different literary perspectives on the Harry Potter novels. And so it's not just one kind of literary criticism. You're actually looking at a lot of different theoretical approaches. And I know that literary critics have actually become quite interdisciplinary in the things that you all are interested in. And I wondered if you could kind of give us an idea of some of the kind of approaches that you think, you know, from literary criticism that are useful, that could be applied to Harry Potter, or that you're seeing in your book.
You're right, we are a pretty eclectic bunch, literary critics, literary literature professors, and we like to steal good ideas from everywhere we can get them. And so
historians are that way too. We like to do that in history.
I got a lot of good proposals that are from a sort of post-colonial perspective, some material culture Marxist sort of perspectives, clearly some queer theory, feminist, and race-based questions that are really interesting to me. There are some more traditional literary analyses, like a careful character analysis of McGonagall.
Oh, that sounds wonderful.
Yeah, I'm really excited about that one. So, yeah, just from all what I had hoped to get and what I did get were just a variety of approaches that demonstrate that we can use our most serious literary questions on these texts productively, and that they illuminate not just the text but also our theory. So that's where we are right now. I'm still sorting through. I got a lot of really good responses and invited the complete essays, and it is really a nice, broad approach.
Yeah, that sounds like the kind of thing that a lot of people would find, you know, their own interests in there, and also to have their interests broadened out to other kinds of perspectives to bring to bear on the Harry Potter stories.
And I think it also says it's okay to be a literature professor who wants to write about Harry Potter. I gave a talk at a graduate student conference last year, and students approached me afterwards sort of quietly saying, you know, my dissertation is on this, but I have this article about Harry Potter that I've been working out in my head. And it was sort of on the side. A lot of, I think, younger academics now are coming out of the closet with their Harry Potterness. It's okay to write about Harry Potter. It's not as okay in literature yet. It needs to be okay in literature too.
Well, it is happening. It really, we're seeing this revival, really. I mean, it's like the third generation of Potter punditry. The generation Hex comes to the Academy. To me, the living example of that is Beatrice Groves at Oxford.
Yeah.
You know, we have an Oxford scholar that's published on Harry Potter and continues to, you know, explode a lot of our ideas about, you know, what we know about Harry Potter. You know, Beatrice routinely blows up. But she's
in the book, John. I invited her, and she's contributing an essay. So is John, by
fantastic.
The way.
Fantastic! That's great.
Full disclosure: John's in there.
All right.
I wanted to ask you about Lev Grossman's Twilight comments. Do you remember that little tempest in the teapot?
Yeah.
Lev made what I took to be a relatively innocent observation that dismissing Twilight as a literary phenomenon because it wasn't grand writing, when she was selling more copies per hour than Jonathan Franzen sold in a year, was simply lazy.
So,
he was crucified. Now, have you had any kind of that blowback to your work here, saying?
Oh, absolutely. But you know what? I teach in a women's college in the middle of the Midwest, so I can't make the same sort of tempest in the teapot that Lev can. But I think that what he was saying is that the work that literature is doing should be important to us. It's not just the literary qualities that we learned about in graduate school. Sometimes literature is doing something else. We called it cultural work in feminist theory in the early days. We talked about Uncle Tom's Cabin, for example, as not so much a literary, capital L literary text, but as one that did important cultural work. And now, you know, we don't read it as much. It's not, there are a lot of other texts that do similar cultural work, some from the voices of African Americans instead of a white person giving us their story. But it was an important way to think about literature, that literature doesn't just sit on a shelf and you pull it out when you take your college courses, that it lives with us every day. How do books live with us every day? And what are they doing for us? And what are they expressing that needs to be expressed? Why is it that for this generation that are coming into the Academy now as professors, that their formative reading experiences were around Harry Potter. So what was that that drew them in? I think we have to ask those questions, even if something so clearly not excellent as Twilight, because we could agree on almost every standard, technically, that we admire the craftsmanship that is part of what we learn to admire in our profession, that these fail, fail utterly. But there is something to pay attention to, and in that sense, I completely agree with that argument. If people are reading them, it's time to pay attention. I was making that argument about Oprah in the early 2000s. I had this snarky comment in my book that there were more sessions on Oprah than Oprah at the MLA for the 3 years I was trying to get an Oprah session going and couldn't. Wow. When she was at the height of her influence, wow. That we should have all been saying, wait a minute, what is she doing and how is she doing it? Because we should be concerned with how books are circulating and how readers are relating to books out there in the world, not just here in our little offices.
There's a wonderful book called The Read Aloud Handbook. I'm forgetting the man's name who wrote it. And in it, he says that there was a renaissance at the end of the 20th century in reading and book sales that is documentable. There's this giant surge in book sales, which nobody anticipated. It was pretty much considered the end of books. And he says that the three things that were responsible for that primarily were a renaissance in book displays, how books were instead of just being bindings only, that they'd show you the full cover, then Oprah, and then Harry Potter. That Oprah and Harry Potter were the three the most important ones, that that no bookseller will tell you that their doors would have remained open without Harry Potter and Oprah bringing new people. And those people didn't know bookstores existed in the mid 90s.
Yeah, I 100% agree with that. The list of I always look at the top selling the list of top selling books every year. And before Oprah, the top selling books were all like Chicken Soup and Something for Dummies and mostly nonfiction, those kind of books. After Oprah started recommending books, for years, all 10 of the top 10 bestsellers of the year were novels. And they were usually almost all Oprah novels. So not just more books, but a different kind of books and a different attitude toward books, I think she was responsible for.
Yeah. And again, the Academy would look at her and say, here's a black woman from the South, and she's made good on a popular conversational television show. I mean, Twilight is considered to be trash largely because of genre bias, right? It's Harlequin romance with vampires. I mean, how low can you go?
But you don't even need the genre bias. You just read a few paragraphs.
don't go there. But what's really, I think you can go lower. I think daytime conversational television is lower in most people's
minds. Yeah, that's a good point, John.
Because you're not even reading, you know?
Yeah.
And yet, these were the things that were, you know, saving literate culture in the United States.
Yeah.
At least in middle brow culture. And that's something I loved about your book. You talked about high brow, middle brow, and low brow culture, and how those ideas have really evolved in critical theory in the last 50 years. I mean, that was so helpful to me. Thank you so much for that. What was the name of that book again, Katie? What was the name of that book again?
The Ulysses Delusion. It's a Palgrave book. It's fun. It's a really good read. And one of the points that you make in that book, Cecilia, that's on the topic of Oprah's book club, is that when she starts doing the book club, she's looking for living authors, so she can obviously have the author on also to participate in the book club, and that she actually gets a real diversity of voices in the authors and the types of novels that she's having people read. A lot of women authors and people of color, but they went to sort of teaching the classics, and it became less like a book club and a little bit more like literature class. And you talk about the Summer of Faulkner, where she's having people sort of read Faulkner, and as soon as they went into the classics, suddenly it's almost all, you know, your kind of dead white guys. It's Faulkner, Tolstoy, I don't care for Faulkner myself,
Steinbeck.
But I do like Tolstoy. But she doesn't have the same diversity. Is this, you know, what's the reason for that? Do you think it's that when we talk about a quote unquote classic, that suddenly we become more restrictive in who we think writes classics, or do you think that this is a feature of once you start doing that, you know, there most of those are being written by most of those considered with that are being written by white men because of a variety of social cultural factors?
Because we defined what is classic, we defined what is excellent by what white men were writing and what white men wanted to teach in our most elite institutions. And so we haven't done the work yet. This is my big argument. It's actually comes from a challenge from Annette Kolodny in an essay she wrote in, I think it was the mid-80s, called Dancing Through the Minefields. And she says what work feminist literary critics have ahead of us. And one of them is to rethink standards of literary merit, because we're not going to be able to just add women to the canon. We have to go back and look at how the canon became the canon. And it was because the work that white men were doing, say, in the 19th century, that we later came to call innovative and interesting and important, like Moby Dick and The Scarlet Letter, they didn't sell well. What was selling well were all of these books by women writers. You know, our famous literary professors love this. Nathaniel Hawthorne called them that damned mob of scribbling women who were making money off of their writing. And these guys, Melville and Hawthorne and others, couldn't make money off of their writing. And so come the 20th century, when we want to teach novels in universities, we chose, we meaning the people in the universities who were teaching the people who were in the universities, which happened to be dominated by mostly white men, chose the books that appealed to them. And they were the books that were written by white men. And so then we defined what makes a good novel by what they were drawing out of those novels. So it's hard to change the way we look at novels until we look at why we say they're good. And if why we say they're good is tied up with gender, race, and class, then we have to untie that a little bit to make a space for writers who are different, doing different work. And I know that a lot of work has been done in recent years. I'm especially impressed by the Vita count that demonstrated that the books that publishers get are equally men and women writers, still mostly white, but by the time you get to what they put out and then what's reviewed and taken seriously, it was so dominantly white male writers. And when this Vida count came out, it's just VIDA, they started counting the number of books reviewed, books published by white men and white women and writers of color. It was just so revealing that even though the whole system is actually more women than men in publishing, that it's tilted so far toward privileging white male writers in the 21st century. So we have work to do to recognize and value qualities of literary merit that aren't situated in this highbrow, privileged world that we've placed them in.
Let me ask you, this is just pure speculation, but I wonder if, you know, especially as we look at, as John calls them, Generation Hex, the kids who grew up reading Harry Potter, who then go on to get degrees and enter the academy and are hopefully making Harry Potter studies, you know, something that is taken seriously. Do you think that Harry Potter and J.K. Rowling will be canonical? Is that something desirable even? Do you think that they'll be, we'll ever consider them, you know, to have the weight of classics? What do you think?
I really hope so. I mean, I think they, even using traditional standards, they stand up to that. I personally enjoyed them much more than, sorry to everyone who's going to object to this, than I enjoyed Tolkien. At one point, I was just so bored with the hobbits that I let them go into Mordor without me. I didn't care anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, they're just so long and just so many battles. And compared to Harry Potter, where you cannot put those books down. I defy anyone to, you know, stop at chapter breaks in those books. It's so hard. And my kids and I always had a hard time stopping because you just want to keep turning the pages. I think that's a valuable quality that she invests in as a technician. She does it in the Robert Galbraith ones too. She's really good at grabbing you and keeping you, you know, she's holding you by the lapels and telling you her story and you can't put it down. So I do think that we'll be reading them in 100 years, if that's the question. And
yes,
I think that they deserve to be read. And I hope that in 100 years, our standards of literary merit care more about what people read and why, and less about what we valued in the aristocratic systems of Western Europe in the centuries before.
I'm gonna jump in here as the token white male on this panel, and shift the conversation a little bit and say, you know, my answer to the question of why these books were so popular wasn't so much, well, how do I put this, was what we call the Iliade thesis. That basically the books, Iliade in the Sacred and Profane says that books serve a mythic or a religious function in a secular culture. That when you drive the spiritual to the periphery, the public square, that you still have a noetic or a spiritual faculty, and it craves oxygen. It wants space to think, and it wants some transcendence of its ego existence. And that's what story does, and that's one reason why we're storytelling people, is that that's our means of transcendence. Mm-hmm. That idea, though, is not an idea which is contained by, certainly has relationships with, all of these socioeconomic, racial, sexual, you know, influences and factors. But if you think that a person is primarily as a spiritual end, that would make why Twilight is so popular, despite its evident failings. That's why Harry Potter is so popular as well, because it's largely about transcending the power meta-narrative, this whole idea of oppressor and oppressed as being our singular focus in life.
Then what do you do with 50 Shades of Grey, John?
Yeah, and Dan Brown's the one I really struggle with. there's a question there, but sexuality, mm-hmm. it's like Muggeridge. Muggeridge says that sex is the mysticism of the materialist, right? If you think yourself as a body, the only way you can transcend yourself is in conjunction with another body. Mm-hmm. And so I think of pornography, imaginative pornography, you know, reading something like 50 Shades of Grey. I think of that as just a means to that end, you know, sort of like, you know, imagination sex.
I really like that idea, and I think that my students and I always read Joseph Campbell as one of the approaches to the Harry Potter books, that idea of a monomyth, the idea that there are things that literature does for a culture. My issue with it is that it has been called universal, and it hasn't been. It's been, even the Joseph Campbell mythology is so based on a white masculine placement in the world, in conversation with spirituality, in conversation with the universe, and myth. It has been named universal when it was actually very narrow. So I worry about those approaches that say this appeals to something deeper and more human until we define that deeper and more human a little more inclusively.
I guess I'm not a Campbellite. In fact, I think that Rowling quite deliberately is not writing after a Campbell model, but is actually parodying that model. That's why she includes all these, you know, very specific trips underground inside every
book. Right.
That's why she has
thresholds.
Why she has the image, the symbol of Christ appear right when Harry dies his near death in every book. That those aren't Campbell elements per se, or they're laughable salutes to that, you know, Campbell element. I see your point, only that the spiritual element of story is something that I'm really missing in literary critique, especially the stuff coming out of the Frankfurt School. You know, that this really quasi-Marxist reading of story, really narrowing down human beings to our power relationships, is, I think, dehumanizing. And Harry Potter is largely against that. You know, Harry Potter is about the meta-narrative of love and transcending self sacrificially and lovingly. The big scene really is at the end of Philosopher's Stone when Grildemort says, I was so naive. I used to believe there was a good and an evil, but there's really only power. And Harry looks into the mirror and sees who he truly is. I mean, he receives the stone, which is, you know, an image of Christ. That's the transcendence of self in love. He's in there ready to die in front of the mirror. Rowling is basically arguing against the meta-narrative of power, which is really the foundation of literary critique. And I question very much whether literary critique, as much as it's based on things like the Frankfurt School and their paradigms, really has much value in discussing Harry Potter when she's assaulting their foundation.
She's certainly well-informed, well-read, intellectually engaged. And I completely agree with you that she has what would be what we have called a spiritual element. I have to say that one is a little bit of a challenge for me too, because that tradition of thinking of the spirituality of texts has also been tied up in some pretty patriarchal models that have ignored a lot of essential aspects of spirituality for people who aren't privileged. So, but let me just ask you one thing. Did you just say Quirldemort? That was like one of the best things I've ever heard. The two-headed Voldemort was Quirldemort. I'm so stealing that one. That is mine now.
Before people start writing in, Katie, I certainly stole that from somebody else. That is not a John original. But yeah, that's
a good way to refer to that. Woo! Whatever the combo is that's at the end of.
This is funny. We have our own little language here.
I was going to say that, and while we're talking about that, there is so much really good critique that happens in these online. In the online Harry Potter verse, in the sort of spaces that the two of you host, but also in fan fiction and the talking back to the text and thinking that you have something to say to the text and about the text. Everybody I know has some Harry Potter theory. All of the students who take the class, they have a paper they want to write, an idea they want to prove. And I think that conversation is really, well, you know, that's what I talked about at the Harry Potter
right.
conference.
Yeah, so
it invites a whole different relationship with readers. It opens up these doors and says, you're in this world now, standing there. What do you see? What do you want to talk about?
And I love that. And if it were more, if people had to be too reverential about it, maybe they wouldn't be able to engage in that level. And what I like is that people love the books, and yet that doesn't stop them from also expressing critique, right? Or,
you know, critique.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what you were talking about. So your plenary speech at the Chestnut Hill Harry Potter Conference last October was called It's Complicated, The Relationship Between Harry Potter Novels and Their Avid Readers. And so I wonder if you could just, you know, explain that a little bit more. Like, what is the relationship between the books and the readers? And what does it tell us about readership generally? You said that you're interested in like reader response and response theory. So what is this telling us about how people in this generation or in relation to the Harry Potter books, how are we reading books?
You know, I made a point of using the language of romantic relationships because people say, I love the Harry Potter novels. And then in the next sentence, they will say, how could she do what she did with Ilvermorny? You know, why doesn't she let Dumbledore be gay? And why aren't there more students of color in a nation that is so clearly more multicultural than Hogwarts is? Why? Right? So
it's complicated.
Because it's not just, you know, I'm putting on my rose-colored glasses and everything about this is perfect. So really what she's doing is half of my job. Like, I don't have to convince students that talking about books is a really good way to spend your time and hone your curiosity and your intellectual astuteness. because they come into the room already wanting to talk about these books like that. And it's different from any other books I've ever taught. So there's something about how inviting that world is, but also that when the students enter it, they feel like they're a part of it and that they claim the right to critique it. I think that's really powerful. There was just an interview with Rowling on Sunday in the New York Times about the cursed child coming to New York. And the ending was really interesting. Did you guys see this?
I did not.
I did.
Asked whether she ever worried about her fans' reactions to extending a universe they treasure. Ms. Rowling sat up straighter. "I think," she said calmly, "that it's up to me what I do with the world I created."
Ooh.
I know, and I love that.
Wow.
She's so completely wrong. I mean, it is her world. She did create it. But once she put those words between the covers of pages and sent them out into the world, people owned them in a different way. They brought them to life in different ways. And they have a say, too. They have a say, too, because it matters to them in these deep and important ways. And she can't hold on or contain all of those interactions. And I think that sometimes that's scary as a writer, you know, because it's sort of making yourself that Barthesian dead author. You don't want to be a dead author. You want to keep saying, "This is what I meant. This is what I meant." But you can't anymore. The book is out there.
Yeah, so the books can be a
man.
The books are kind of a fixed text. So you've got that world of the book that's supposed to be fixed, but then, like you say, we've still got J.K. Rowling's voice through the tweets and the interviews and Pottermore, and she's telling us, "Well, maybe you're reading it wrong," or "Right, no, this is what I really intended for that character." And in a way, she's getting in the way of what readers are doing that's keeping it alive and discussable.
What's that really good fan fiction that's a serious Lupin romance, something, The Box, I can't remember the name right now.
I don't know.
I've just been reading it, and it's so good. It imagines the relationship that many of us while reading the books imagined, which was a deeper affection between Lupin and Sirius than friendship, that it was friendship plus, that they were actually a couple. Hmm. And then when that was not a part of the text that came after, people were disappointed. And I think, you know, there's a legitimate argument to be made that in those earlier books that relationship seemed like it could be
and
more.
Your talk was really about that kind of pause, that long pause that we had between book 4 and book 5, right? Where people were just waiting, and in the waiting.
A 3-year summer.
Right.
they
filled in.
Yeah, were filling in.
That's a great moment that I didn't realize until I started talking to all these people who love Harry Potter. By the way, that fanfic is called The Shoebox Letters, I think.
Oh, yeah. I had a student write about those as you were describing
they're
it.
So good.
Yeah.
They're so good. Anyway, that in that gap, students or the readers of Harry Potter became writers of Harry Potter stories because they needed to know what happened, and they already imagined they were living in Hogwarts, so they could imagine what comes next. So a lot of great stuff came out of that pause.
You talk about also how people, you know, try to imagine. I think one of the things you talked about was somebody who's Indian, sort of imagining Indian Harry Potter. Like, what would it be like? Am I remembering that correctly?
No, this was a really fierce critique of the Ilvermorny story.
Oh, okay.
It was this young woman who I think she is a graduate student now. I'm not sure, but she still writes and she's an activist around Native American issues. I don't have her name right in front of me, but she was saying that she loves Harry Potter and she lives in the Potterverse. She writes and thinks about Harry Potter, but this thing that you did, Rowling, it is wrong and you need to stop. You need to stop misrepresenting Native traditions, smashing a bunch of indigenous cultures together and coming up with things that work for your books, for your stories. That's not how you treat the people who are still here and living those cultural traditions. And while she's doing it, she's saying, "But I love Harry Potter. I love these books." But yeah, stop doing that, she says, very
right.
Seriously. And, you know, the Cho Chang, the famous Rachel Rostad Cho Chang performance piece really upset the way we thought about Cho Chang in those texts because it's such a strong critique and so convincing. But she also stands right in the middle of Harry Potter world and says, I love this world. That's why I'm such a serious critic. It should be better.
And it strikes me that, you know, we see a lot of social activism in this generation too. And I wonder if people are sort of, you know, I've said this before that I don't think people were kind of irritated by some of the power imbalances and some of the sexism that appeared in the wizarding world. And I suggest that Rowling is not really trying to create a perfect world. She's trying to replicate some of the problems in our world. And maybe people also feel as though like they want to get in, not, you know, both our world and the wizarding world and try to right those wrongs and
make it utopic. Well, and why not? Like if young people aren't doing that, then there's something wrong with the way we've delivered the world to them. They have to be able to imagine it better. And yeah, the fact that they practiced that in Harry Potter. Well, don't you just love the Harry Potter Alliance that they brought people right. together around Harry Potter values?
Oh yeah.
And are changing the world together. That's just super powerful. I love that.
Really amazing. One of their campaigns was to basically make sure that the Harry Potter chocolates were being made with free trade chocolate.
Yeah.
And they
yeah.
made a house elf comparison. I love the house elves. So they made a comparison between the laborers, especially the child laborers who were involved in, you know, coffee production, and the house elves, and they said, you know, you need to be better than this, and you need to, you need to free these people who are in basic servitude, and it was successful.
That's the best thing about the Harry Potter Alliance. They bring a lot of people together, and they make a big difference.
I want to jump in here and talk a bit about this fan activism and the fan engagement with the series. I've never been a big reader of fan fiction. I've been doing a little more of that. I'm not a real rock and roll person, so that wasn't a big thing. But what I was really intrigued by fan fiction and by wizard rock was that it was artistry, you know, really intentional, prolonged. These books, these fan fiction pieces are forever. That was really individual engagement with a text that went, you know, beyond just your normal, I like this book, I'm going to try to write something like it.
Yeah, isn't it? That's.
But now we're moving into something that it's like, that's dying. Those things are really fading from the Harry Potter scene outside of, you know, the like Leaky Con and this, that. You'll see Harry and the Potter and Draco and the Malfoys. But what we're seeing now, really, is we're seeing Hogwarts Mystery come out, the new mobile game. And we're going to, and you mentioned earlier that everybody says, gosh, I'm still waiting for my letter, you know, with the owl. That's how Hogwarts Mystery opens, is, you know, you're going to be staring at your phone walking around and the owl is.
Oh, is this the one that's
letter.
Like Pokemon Go, only with Harry Potter?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I just put the trailer up at Hogwarts Professor and did my little chicken little dance, because I really do think this is the end of the line. We've been seeing this commercialization and degradation of the imaginative experience, where the high point of it really is fan fiction and wizard rock, which is essentially poetry with music, the combination of those things. So you've got literature, poetry, music, which is extrapolations from text, and the insertion of individual experience and reflection. And now you're going to have a game where people will be walking around with basically the Warner Brothers images from the books. You'll have no creative involvement in it at all, rather than except for not being hit in traffic when you're walking around with your phone. Am I wrong in doing my chicken little dance? Should I not despair so much about this?
And you know, if I could just insert here too, this is actually reminding me of an essay that I think is in your book, A Wizard of Their Age, that was a compilation of essays by undergraduates who I think somebody did write about maybe the theme park as a simulated experience of living in the Harry Potter world. So, so share with us, what do you think? Is this the end of Harry Potter civilization as we know it?
No. In fact, I really, really want to play that game. I was one of those Pokemon Go people 2 summers ago. I think that's any ways that readers reinvent interaction with text is interesting to me. This might be more interaction with movie, but just the idea that this imaginative world has become so compelling that it keeps expanding out and out. I don't really see a degradation. I just see a constant reaffirmation that these books aren't just something that are going to be put on shelves and ignored. This is life-changing for a lot of the people involved in it, and they, wherever they're going to be, they're going to bring it with them. So if they're gamers, it's going to show up there. You know, if they're cops, maybe something good will show up there. If they're teachers, something good will show up because of what they got from growing up with these books.
When you say that, it reminds me of a book you were talking about earlier, namely Uncle Tom's Cabin, which has unfortunately now been consigned to the dust heap for the most part. Because Uncle Tom's Cabin shapes American entertainment for, 100 years? I mean, it Shirley Temple starts her career, you know, playing parts from Uncle Tom's Cabin on stage.
Right.
American theater is revived largely so they could do Tom shows.
It's in The King and I.
That's right. I mean, it's really, besides her, you know, supposedly starting the Civil War, the book changed America. Really, if you like Marvel comic book movies, which are almost all vigilante films, you have to understand it all comes from Harriet Beecher Stowe. That she invents the vigilante novel. It was Lenin's favorite novel. I mean, this is the revolutionary piece. Basically, she invites lawlessness for justice. That idea that a book could so permeate a culture that its effect would be felt for generations.
And
maybe that's what we're seeing here in things like Hogwarts Mystery. I'm constantly, in my dark room surrounded by books doing the, things are getting worse and worse. my Puddle Club posture. But I do wonder very much, because the imaginative experience is less and less. It's so different than it was when, again, these are things I didn't participate in. I wasn't a fan fiction reader or writer, and I certainly didn't compose Wizard Rock, and I didn't go to concerts. But I had to admire, what the books were doing and what people were doing with the books, that we were getting that kind of phenomenon from within the reader. But when you buy an app that, gives you a game, and you play the game, that seems to be a qualitative difference.
You could argue, though, that that's more engaging than watching the movies, that it's at least participatory. I think that the point that you make about the comparison that you make with Uncle Tom's Cabin is really good, because that did influence culture a lot in the moment when it came out, and then in the years after. But what we discovered as we read it and reread it in different contexts is that it does it from a very white supremacist perspective. The audience that appreciates it and loves it through that century was mainly white people, and there was constant critique by African Americans about that text and how, I mean, that one of the underlying messages is, suffer with dignity because your reward is in heaven. And that's not a kind of patience that we want to encourage people to have. Oh, just wait, it'll be okay when you die, right? So there were a lot of things that went wrong for late 20th century and 21st century audiences of that text. It doesn't take away from the fact that historically and culturally it was really important. It did really important work, but it maybe did it good enough, well enough, that now we say, yeah, you didn't quite get it where we needed to be now in the 21st century. And, there's a possibility that Harry Potter, the mistakes that we call out will be so deep 100 years from now that we won't be reading it with the same energy and enthusiasm. You never know, because we don't know. This stands the test of time thing is such a weird measure. There's nothing that stands the test of time by itself, because,
Paul
Lauder says it's people sift. Time doesn't sift anything. It's the people who sift, not Paul Lauder. That's anyway. In the literary criticism I teach, time sifts nothing. It's the people who sift. So we sifted Uncle Tom's Cabin, and I think rightfully so, because it doesn't do enough of the work that we're doing in the 21st century. So, yeah, I don't know. I guess it comes back to, I'm super excited about that game coming out, and I'll be playing it, and don't hit me with your car.
I have to say, if my 10-year-old finds out about this game, I'm never going to see him again. He's just going to get lost in it. Oh, my gosh. It's a miracle that we survived the Pokemon Go. Although, if he gets a hold of that, he's also gone. So, I'm interested in hearing a little bit more about the undergraduate volume that you put together, A Wizard of Their Age, that's sort of maybe on this topic, right? And we can maybe see what that group of undergraduate students did with it. And, you know, does this give us an idea of how millennials are ready to approach Harry Potter? And what did you learn through that experience of helping to compile this volume of undergraduate scholarly essays on Harry Potter?
You know, just about everything I know about Harry Potter, I learned through the interactions with the students that I've been teaching in these classes. And though that collection of essays came out of the very first Harry Potter class I ever had, when the students just wrote incredibly powerful essays because they were so interested in sorting through ideas around these texts. And then we put out a call for papers and got a bunch more that were very similar, where students were deeply engaging with the text from different perspectives. So it was a really great shift for me in my thinking as a critic, because I thought that I was paying attention to readers carefully and well, and I was still missing a lot. And when I started paying attention to these students and their relationship with Harry Potter, it really deepened my understanding of that reader-text relationship that has been my concern for a long time. So when they wrote, like, my favorite essay, well, I probably shouldn't say that in where people can hear it, but my favorite essay in that book is this really clever analysis of the wizarding gene from chemistry major and a nursing major, who just said they really do this great, they use Punnett squares and everything. They trace the genetics of Harry Potter and how you can be a squib or a wizard. And they do it by assuming that everybody has the wizarding gene. We all have a little bit of wizard in us. And then the way it gets expressed is, I can't do the science. But the essay is such a really clever combination of kind of literary criticism and textual analysis and the science that they know and they're using in their classes. And it just turned out, in a way, it's a different essay from any that I had ever read in the context of literary criticism. And I just found it delightful. And then we had a nurse do a nursing care plan for Voldemort. The way they approached the text from their disciplines and had something to say, it wasn't just a bunch of English majors writing about the Great Gatsby. It was something really different and valuable. So the book came out of that experience. I said, wow, you guys write better about these books than the literary critics I'm reading. So how do we get your ideas out there and gather the ideas of this generation? And they said, we should do our own book.
That's cool. Let's put on a show. I love that.
Like,
that's great.
Anybody publish a collection of undergraduate essays? That just seemed, you know, like it probably wouldn't happen. And in fact, it was rejected a couple of places before I went to my friends at SUNY, where I had published books about Oprah, and said, this is what I have. And they said, wow, let's do that. James was really helpful there. Yeah.
That's great. And, you know, you're just reminding me, I try to have my students write, it's called Harry Potter and the Liberal Arts. It's a freshman seminar that I teach, and I try to have them, you know, look at how we can look at Harry Potter from different disciplinary perspectives, and then they're supposed to come up with a project that would take a different disciplinary perspective. And I have had really interesting range, and I think they are paying attention to things I am not always aware of, and so I find new things to include in the class, you know, because somebody found this great thing, or they show me a meme that's been going around, and they're really tuned in a way that it's really fun to participate in.
That's what Patrick and who does Patrick teach with at
Karen Wendling.
Yes, that's what they discovered as they were teaching too. And it pushed their thinking about texts in different directions. I really like Patrick's Philosophy and Mythology, Into the Pensive book. That's so good.
Oh, yeah, it's beautiful.
Yeah, they do a good job with also acknowledging, and I Patrick, I call him my favorite hermeneut. He has this literary critical approach that's different from mine, but also the same way of honoring what he learns from students. And yeah, I really appreciate that, because when you're in a teaching situation, you know, you really do, you want this stuff that you're teaching to land, and you want it to make a difference. And the way that you do that is to be in a relationship. It's probably the whole J.K. Rowling, love is the most powerful force in the universe thing, to get all squishy about it. But you know, when you are in that relationship with students, what they think and what they care about has to matter to you if you're going to be a good teacher. And I think when we really listen to those students and respond to what interests them, our level of understanding of these texts shoots way up.
Right. And that's Patrick McCauley, who wrote the Into the Pensive, and then Karen Wendling. And they're the ones who really organized that Chestnut Hill Conference as a way to get, you know, scholars at a variety of levels, including undergraduates and even high school students, to participate in conversations together. I just think that's one of the greatest things about that conference.
And then the next day that you just get to play and go to this Harry Potter festival with all these people dressed up and
Quidditch.
Just a blast.
Butterbeer. Oh, yeah, that was so much fun. Yeah, that's a good event. Well, I'm sorry to say that we are out of time. We are going to ask our closing question, which is, Cecilia, if you could ask one question of J.K. Rowling on Veritaserum, so she has to tell you the truth, what would you ask her?
You know, I got this question in advance, and I really don't, it's so funny to me that I don't know how to answer that, because in my as I guess I have a sort of narrowed critical approach in that I really don't care so much
care
what the author thinks. I don't. And I don't care really where the books come from, what her psychological situation was, who she was grieving and why. I am so focused on the relationship between reader and text that the author almost always gets left out of my analysis. And I'm really glad that there are a lot of people out there who care about that question, because it will help give us a more rounded approach to the text, to you know, if we come at it from a lot of different directions as literary critics, all the better. But that's not a question that I even know how to answer.
That is not your direction. That is a first,
Cecilia. That is a beautiful answer. I want to follow up that immediately and say, how much of Harry Potter's success is because of Harry Potter's success is because it's a brilliantly written series of books. The explosive growth of it, how much of that do you think is attributable to the fact that here is a beautiful, intelligent, witty, you know, a dynamic interview? I mean, this person is, if booksellers wanted to invent the person they wanted to present as the literary life, could they think of a better person than J.K. Rowling? Could they have invented a person better than J.K. Rowling to present their case?
She's pretty amazing. And if I were going to have a question for her, I would tweet it at her, because her Twitter personality is somebody that I'd really like to sit down and have a beer with. I mean, she really is fascinating. I love that the richest woman in the world for a while there, before she started giving her money away, was a writer. When people say, you shouldn't be an English major, what will you ever do with that? You'll never have money. Like, really? The richest two richest women in the world at one point were Oprah Winfrey and J.K. Rowling, who are both involved with literature. So, yeah, I agree with you. Her personality has a lot to do with the success, but I don't think it made it made those books the phenomenon they are. Well, she certainly was the writer, but her appearing as the writer in public, I don't think that makes that big a difference.
No, she really didn't catch her stride, her control as a spin doctor, if you will, until after the books were out. Really, until she changed her agents to Neil Blair. I mean, where she really takes control of that whole thing. Anyway, Rowling is a, I can't think of any author other than Dickens that is so much of a public personality, the public writer that.
Stephen King. If you do have some Veritaserum to spare, because I didn't use it, I could really use it in other situations, though. So pass it on over here.
Thank you so much for running your book. The title of that book is
The Ulysses Delusion.
And
love.
I'm sorry if it sounds like I'm just banging the drum here on that, but I read this book.
It's about to come out in paperback. Let me just put that plug in.
Oh, great.
It would be actually affordable.
For example, just the chapter on Ayn Rand in this book was worth the cost of purchase.
And you know, Celia, I would say this, like, one of the things that I love is a bad review that makes you want to read the book anyway. And so much of what you do these investigations of different types of books that are popular for a variety of reasons. And even the ones you didn't like, I was like, I might have to pick that up.
Cecilia, thank you for your running this book. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for all you're doing to advance Potter punditry and Potter scholarship. Really, you're a godsend to Potter fandom. And it's been just a pleasure and delight to have you on Katie's show.
Yes, thank you so much for coming.
I really enjoyed it. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, such a good, vigorous conversation. And I do think that, you know, talking with students about Harry Potter is just such a rich area for development. And I hope that we're building, you know, great readers and people who take those things with them, no matter what they're doing later on in their lives. I was thinking about, you know, if you've published a book, published a chapter in a book, you know, that you take that confidence with you and the other things that
do.
So that's just a wonderful thing to be able to offer to students. So thank you again for joining us for the podcast today and sharing your thoughts about reading Harry Potter in the Academy. Hopefully he is not quite the prisoner of the Academy, as I suggested in the title.
It's a great title, though. Thank you.
I couldn't resist. I found myself sort of headed in that direction. And thanks also, of course, to John Granger for being our continuing expert guest.
And a fun sparring partner.
You know, Cecilia, it's great to have a perfect foil. You know, I think you and I are perfect foils, and I like you. That makes it even more fun. You know, you bite your tongue and say, "Yeah, I can sort of see your point," but you know, anyway.
Same.
Always up for a good debate. That's great. And everyone, always be on the alert for signups for John's online class, Wizard Reading Formula. Is that coming out soon, John?
Yes, we're working on what they call the sales funnel now.
Okay.
All
right, so stay tuned. And
it's coming.
I'd also like to give a big thanks to our technical editor in Australia, Emma Nicholson. Emma, thank you. You do a fantastic job. And we, of course, always appreciate our partners at MuggleNet, the number one Harry Potter fan site. Thanks to MuggleNet for all that you do. We appreciate you. And speaking of which, dear listeners, we are glad also that you joined us today. And we would love it if you would leave a comment or question for us or contact us through email at readingwritingrolling@gmail.com. Or you can tweet us at readwriteroll, READ. WRITEROWL on Twitter. Let us know what you'd like to hear more about. Give us some of your feedback, and we will try to practice some, you know, listener response as well. And so now I will leave you all with the wisdom of Hogwarts Headmaster and Supreme Mugwump of the International Confederation of Wizards, Albus Dumbledore, who said, "Words are, in my not-so-humble opinion, our most inexhaustible source of magic, capable of both inflicting injury and remedying it." We'll see you next time, where we'll be using our words to make some magic.